I'll start giving you a sort of background and rationale for the book in itself. It's a very long journey into the world of the Indian sweatshop that went through many phases. I started with my doctoral work when I was more concerned with grappling with the behavior of large exporters in India, then into other phases where instead my focus went first on subcontracting networks, then on labor contracting, then more on workers' voices themselves. So in a sense, this is, I think, emerges partially from the narrative and also involved the use of very mixed methods for data collection, and I would not have time to go into this during the presentation of the book here, but I'm very happy to actually answer questions on this. So what was my scope with writing this book? Well, at the very basic level, I think the book is aligned with the other studies that are concerned with the poor working conditions of global garment workers and Indian garment workers in particular. And recently, but after the Rana Plaza collapse in 2013 in Dhaka, there have been quite a few books that come out concerned with this. We have Jeremy Seabrook's The Song of the Shirt. We have Tansy Oskin's The Anti-Capitalist Book of Fashion. We have quite a few. So I'm actually quite pleased with this book to join these concerned accounts after so many years of engaging with garment workers. Indeed, I think we cannot stress ever enough the poor living condition, working and living conditions in which they find themselves in. However, I have to say that, of course, I also had a far more ambitious scope with this book, and that is an attempt to theorize the sweatshop. Why to theorize it? Well, to make sense of its extraordinary resilience in India as well as across the globe. If you think when we talk about Rana Plaza in 2013, that the first ever disaster in the history of garment making traces back 1911 in New York City, and I'm talking about the shirtwaist factory fire that killed over 40 women of migrant origin, mainly Jewish and Italian, after a major fire. So during this presentation, what I'm trying to do is to convince you that we have to understand the sweatshop as a regime, and in a quite complex definition that I provide quite earlier on in the book, a system of labor exploitation and oppression which is made of multiple spaces of work, which crosses the realms of production and reproduction of the workers involved, which is crafted by multiple masters across both domains of production and circulation, and also that entails a constant health depleting effect for the workers involved. So even when we don't observe industrial disasters, we have to remind ourselves that this is hugely taxing work on a daily basis that effectively have long-term effects on the health of workers in India and worldwide. So in short, if I had to like summarize this very complex definition in a few lines, here the sweatshop is not defined as a space or a place, but as a set of labor relations and practices. And this has implications for a number of key debates in development studies and development economics, in my view. First of all, that on industrial development, and particularly ideas of stagism, that for sectors like garment and textile are very sticky in the disciplines. The idea that you have the cheap labor model as one of the temporary evils of the first phases of industrial development, and therefore we should actually sort of let it pass or like endure it for the for better times to come. Well, the book of course tries to deconstruct quite strongly this narrative, and also has implication for another more recent debate, which in a sense is a opposite specular of that on that poses industrial development as a benign force, which is that of modern slavery, which instead tends to represent the sweatshop workers as modern slaves, which again has a number of problems and pitfalls that we will discuss later on. The book effectively engages with three key debates. The third one is on ethical consumerism and on private labor standards and the way in which they have participated themselves in reproducing the sweatshop across time and space. But I've written a fair amount of this, so I'm not talking about this today. Of course, I'm happy again to answer questions. Now, of course, for a book that is titled The Sweatshop Regime, I have to sort of locate it a little bit in the literature. And of course, I took inspiration from the work of Michael Bourovoy's on factory regimes in 1987. Where he actually looks at the relevance not just of the labor process, i.e. of relations in production, but also looks at capital-labor relations more at large in a national and international context. So, of course, the book is inspired by Bourovoy's narrative, but with reference to developing settings and emerging economies, even more inspired by the more recent work by Poon Nai and Chris Smith on China, where they identify as, moving the attention from factory to labor regimes, they make the crucial contribution to highlight how we need to look at reproductive domains as well to fully understand the working and living conditions of workers in the textile, garment, and other light manufacturing industries. Finally, like also more recently, we have a revival of interest on issues of labor control, which again expands the reach of narratives on labor regime with the work of Mark Anner, Penn State, but also even more recently, Elena Baglioni and Jonathan Pattenden. Now, I called it the sweatshop regime and not labor regime because, of course, I wanted to place the emphasis on the materiality of the commodity garment, which is a key trope in the analysis. You are what you make, particularly in the Indian context. There is a very strong correspondence between certain things made and the people who make them. And also because I wanted to directly place the emphasis on the harsh working conditions we talk about here and the complexities that lies behind the cheap labor model, to deconstruct also this model. Also, the attention to social reproduction, which is paid in the book, is not simply that on the daily social reproduction of the workforce. What does it mean? It means that Poon Nai and Chris Smith look at the reality of dormitories, for instance, to understand the conditions of the workers they're looking at in China. Of course, daily social reproduction is crucial, but in the book, I try to engage with a much wider understanding of social reproduction to include the places of origins of workers and the type of power dynamics that actually take place, particularly in peri-urban and rural areas, in areas which are becoming increasingly the outpost of the sweatshop. Finally, the word sweatshop also evokes this, making reference to textile and garment, evokes also the mercantile nature of this industry, which is such for a long time, since the Indian Ocean trade period, and of course the issue of the interplay between production and circulation is another concern of the book. Now, the book grapples also with the literature on global commodity chains, which perhaps is less of interest for this audience. I'll just say very few words. I choose not to focus on the chain, but on the to focus on the sweatshop as a regime, because this is a study of labor, and I think there is a qualitative difference and a representational difference in like using labor as a prism to the study of the global economy as opposed to studying the way in which globalization impacts on labor. So the protagonist of this story is labor and labor practices, and therefore the chain is here represented as a sweatshop regime. Now, which type of types of debates I want to contribute to with this book? Because effectively, whenever we choose whenever we choose dispositives like the chain, the network, a regime. We're trying to engage with a broader debate. And here I try to engage with two. One is the biggest one, capitalism, so the theorization of the sweatshop that emerges from the analysis proposes a specific view of capitalism and also a specific view of class. Regarding capitalism, here capitalism is represented as a mode of production which is based on the extraction of labor surplus, but not defined by the presence or absence of wage labor or free labor, but that is based on a multiplicity of forms of exploitation. And this is clearly inspired by the work of Jairus Banerjee. And also, quite more fundamentally, I would say, in these different forms of exploitation, this multiple way we have of exploiting workers are not transitional. So there is a process of reproduction of all the possible ways in which you can be exploited in the garment industry today, which are quite stable, after all. And this is due to the fact of the presence of highly differentiated markets. Also, there is a specific understanding of class, which is proposed here. And clearly, the way in which I look at class is very much in line with Henry Bernstein's proposition of classes of labor, i.e. class is seen as given by a multiplicity of labor relations at work, and also is not conceptualized just in productivist ways, i.e. starting from the point of production. Because as you will see, the workers that are part of the sweatshop regime are really multiple and diverse, and they will be placed on different parts of the employment ladder and paid a different price on the basis of their own body. That is, they themselves are turning to raw materials, and the social identity of workers is no secondary complication to the study of the sweatshop regime. So a woman, a migrant, a young male workers, they all place in very qualitatively different parts of the sweatshop regime, and this corresponds to specific cost minimization strategies of employers. So in a sense, to engage with class, we have to engage with both realms of production and reproduction, and crucially with the issue of social identity of workers, which is not just an add-on to class, but is a constitutive element of processes of class formation. And of course here I learned a lot from Barbara's work, while a paper with Nandini Gupta in 2001 mapping the worlds of India's unorganized labor, her later work on India Working, but also from the work of great feminists in India, like Lila Fernandez, who has a fantastic study of the jute industry, Karin Kapadia, and also Mary John. The two leading accounts, feminist accounts, in relation to the way in which production and social reproduction intertwine in the book are indeed the writings of Maria Mies and, more recently, Silvia Federici. And Federici, in particular, in the analysis, helps me bringing home issues health depletion, or like the understanding the sweatshop as a bodily regime, which entail also considering the human body as the first ever machine invented by capitalism, paraphrasing from Federici's work, because this is really clearly what emerges then from the narrative. Looking at debates on Indian capitalism, the book wants to contribute to two specific debates. One is the way in which modern global India works, and the other one deals with issues of regionalism. So on the one hand, the book, the sweatshop here, tries to provide a window into the world of Indian labor, and it shows how not only you have a dominance of informalized labor relations, but these are progressive processes which one can see both in factory and non-factory realms first. So in a sense, if you look at the aggregate data provided by the National Commission for Enterprises in the unorganized sector, it sets clearly two trends at work in India. One is the increase of informal labor practices of different types, or an expansion of the informal sector, and the other one is instead a rising in process of informalization in otherwise organized settings. Now, in a sense, the study of the sweatshop that I propose here clearly empirically shows the ways in which these processes actually take place in an industry in different qualitative ways across the subcontinent. And what he also tries to argue is that this is due to processes which, yes, affect the realm of labor, but they also affect the realm of capital, meaning that when we talk about process of informalization, we need to pay attention to a twofold pathway. One is the process of labor informalization, and the other is the process of informalization of capital, which is crucial, particularly in a country where you have a specific mercantile features that appear in so many different industries. The second contribution relates to the need to address capitalist trajectories in massive social formation like India, and not just India, probably talking about Brazil or South Africa, massive countries which have great diversity in terms of regions, where we need to recognize that these trajectories will vary very much. And indeed, if you look at the work I've done for the book, I followed quite a crazy trajectory where I compared 8 different places, and they showed indeed a very interesting story of regionalism across India. The places which I'm gonna be briefly talk about are indicated here, and they're Delhi, Ludhiana, Jaipur, Calcutta, Mumbai, Chennai, Bangalore, and Tirupur. These are the urban areas where I did fieldwork on garment export, and then in the last part of the last 2 to 3 years I spent instead on studying processes of internal outsourcing from urban centers to peri-urban areas, which led me to Bareilly in western Uttar Pradesh. Now, the sweatshop as a regime. In trying to convince you that we have to portray the sweatshop as a regime, I'm going to talk about what I think are the co-constitutive elements of this regime. And in a sense, the book used these co-constitutive elements for its division in chapters. So after the introduction and the first chapter, where I try to make my case for shifting the attention to the garment commodity chain, to the sweatshop, then I go on in trying to map which are these elements crucial to our understanding of the sweatshop regime. The first of this composing element is the relationship between the physical and the social. So the materialities of production which are at work in the garment industry are multiple, and they correspond in a sense to these relations that of course is present very much in Marx, between competition and exploitation. The second constitutive element is the fact that the sweatshop is crossed by multiple patterns of difference and unfreedom. The third is the representation of the sweatshop as a joint enterprise, which means that we have to look at multiple masters in order to understand the way in which surplus is extracted from garment workers inside the sweatshop. And also the fourth is instead, fourth constitutive element is the representation of the sweatshop, the need to represent the sweatshop as a bodily regime with specific health depleting effects. Now, let's try to just at least spend a few words on each of these constitutive elements. Now, from the physical to the social. Now, it's in after, I would say, a decade of interviews with garment buyers, garment exporters, retailers, etc., it's really clear how they see India. And they see it as the equivalent of a massive garment mall, if you want a massive H&M or a massive Primark, well, you have different type of garment collections available at different floors. So if you want to, let's say, source a nicely embroidered blouse, you will go to place X. Instead, if you want to get a pair of jeans, you will get to place Y. So in a way, they fetishize the entire country as a place where they can actually get the X number of commodities, and of course, product specialization serves the purpose to guarantee to these actors the cheapest price possible. Now, of course, I'm very much aware that studies that start from the commodity can be always accused of commodity fetishism, although this is how employers actually think. And so, in a sense, yes, of course, it's commodity fetishism, but this commodity fetishism has a very real effect in the world of labor, because it actually creates specific labor relations and practices which are particularly sticky in a given context. Now, so this is India, how it's seen by the exporters, retailers, and global buyers in question. It's a country where you can actually outsource a different number of different garment items, so that the word garment actually doesn't give justice to the level of product differentiation you can actually have. I'm very proud of my sketches here, because these are like my designs, although they were like realized by the wonderful Ezel Inns, which is a great jazz person. Now, starting from the north, starting from the north, you have here the realm of niche-based product, which means that if I'm the H&M or the Primark in question, is where I will go if I need to have short run and like a few fashionable item that, you know, required a lot of embroidery or a lot of value addition. So you have Belly, which specializes in embroidered ladies' wear. You have Jaipur, where ladies' wear has links with the printing, traditional printing industry. You have Ludhiana, which is specialized in woolens. So these are like all niche markets characterized by shorter runs with a higher, with a relatively decomposed product cycle, and where you will have the tendency to organize production in smaller size factories. And you get to Calcutta, where again you have a highly decomposed product cycle, but in this case, because it's a low-end market, this is where you will get your nightie, you will get your kids' wear, you will get your work wear. And instead, in the south, you find a complete different world of scenes machines at work. You have mainly basic production and mass production of basic items, jeans, jacket, t-shirts, of course, in Tirupur, which is the t-shirt town in India. There are people that have done far more work than me on this, like Dhanav and Vijaya Bhaskar, and of course Sharad Chari before them. So here you have a type of garment which is where the Indian content, if you want, is slightly less. It uses less of a craft-based activities in India, and it's more of a global garment. You can find this stuff produced also in Pakistan or Bangladesh, at least far more than you will have instead here, where there is a sort of premium placed on the incorporation of artisanal activities inside. I just placed Mumbai here as the till of our massive India Mart, because effectively, although Mumbai is registered as a key export center, there's very little production going on there, and the exporters who are based in Mumbai actually outsource production across the whole of India on the basis of which type of market they engage with, so they behave like proper buyers. Now, why is this relevant? This is a picture of how competition looks like internally. And as Marx said, and it's not a case that he started Capital Volume 1 with a chapter on commodities, is because there is a correspondence with clear different patterns of exploitation. So this is what I mean when I say that the sweatshop regime entails very different forms of exploitation, and these are not just transitory. These make a hell of a lot of sense on the basis of the different final market you engage with. So again, starting from the north, when we learned that we had niche products and smaller runs or like more complex product cycle, here you will have a combination of different classes of labor composed by male migrant from the Hindi belt in factories, which are generally of smaller size. 80% of the labor force in factory here is casualized. Different forms of casualization are at work. And instead, you have also a huge amount of home-based or non-factory labor, which is, yes, external. It looks like peripheral to the product cycle itself, but as a matter of fact, provide key value addition. And you have combinations of tiny micro-enterprise labor with the classic outworkers, generally all female, with instead household enterprises. In Delhi, household enterprises are practically disappearing. It costs a lot of money to actually set up the self-employment of this type in Delhi. However, exported decentralized production all the way to Bareilly. And actually, from Bareilly itself, now production is getting, at least by the end of 2013, beginning of 2014, was getting stretched all the way with the borders with Uttarakhand, because they need a huge amount of hands at work. Embroidery is really key to this type of product cycles here. Now, here in the south, well, instead you have a completely different setup. You produce your jeans and you have runs of, let's say, 100,000 jackets. So this is mass production. Here you find Chennai and Bangalore, where you have rates of feminization inside the factory that reach 80 to 90%. So we don't have our male migrants from the Hindi belt. We have local commuters. They're all women, majority of them. In Bangalore lately, there is a need of new hands. So the new sort of trend is like some migration is coming, particularly from Odisha, with, of course, huge problems for the unions. This is the possibly the best unionized place it was. And in Tirupur, you have a mix and match of northern and southern trends. Because you have, of course, a knitwear sector that was originally very small scale and male dominated, that instead is developing through a sort of garmenting phase, whereby you find feminization in stitching factories. And I'm sure that Judith knows much more than me on the Tirupur case. And the Tirupur effect is expanding far beyond the actual area of Tirupur, as Judith and Grace Carswell have shown. Now, so this to say that this correspondence between competition and exploitation actually is quite real, and we talk about, it's relevant for us to talk about commodities because there is this very strong correspondence between the things you do and the way you are exploited, if you want to put it quite bluntly. And of course, we just started to define our classes of labor and their variability across the sweatshop regime, because the second feature of the sweatshop regime is the fact that it's crossed by multiple manifestations of difference and unfreedom. So let's go back to our map. Why is this relevant to stress this? Well, first, because if you look at the sweatshop literature in India as elsewhere, they tend to isolate extreme cases. So we read in papers about forced labor, we read about trafficked workers. There's a tendency to go for the worst forms of abuse and to simply link the debate on unfreedom to this type of instances. Well, as a matter of fact, there are different forms of unfreedom that are at work here, and there might even be trade-offs between the two. But let's first start with the difference. Now, when we talk about garment, this is not really a big caste story, unlike other sectors. And although it was a caste story when it started, so for instance, if you interview producers that have been in business since the 80s, they clearly tell you that at the beginning, darzis were a huge component of the product of the labor force, and it's hardly surprising given that it's a tailoring caste. But of course, as export boomed, this caste class next splintered, and recent surveys, both in the north but also in the south, we did surveys in the north, in the south, there is evidence coming from other sources, do not necessarily identify specific caste at work. Like if you talk to trade union, they're identified in the caste of poverty, or like people that anyway, in class terms, you would define as impoverished. In our own survey, the last one, 80% of our workers were OBCs. Where you do still observe a caste nexus, however, is in the marginal segments of the sweatshop regime, particularly in activities which are ancillary. So in the north, for instance, we identified first there are pockets, communities of low caste Muslims that are massively involved into ancillary activities like embroidery. There is still some in Jaipur, some linkages with the printing, so you'll find Chipa communities here that are linked to the most labor intensive parts of printing, and also in the work of many working in Tirupur, they have identified, for instance, Dalit to community engaging in highly hazardous tasks like dyeing. So there is sort of a caste story to be told at the periphery of all this, but when you look at estimates on the garment workers themselves in workshop, you don't see it, and it's quite easily understandable why, because of course you have the splintering of this nexus. In terms of unfreedom, it's interesting to sort of try to put the question of unfreedom into the perspective that you adopt. Sweatshop studies tend to go for the big story, the trafficked person or the forced labor, etc. But this is hardly where the story stops. And if you have liberal, if you take a liberal view of unfreedom, you can actually depict the sweatshop regime and having specific trends. For instance, here you will find that unfreedom manifests itself with the rates of new bonded labor in peri-urban and rural areas, where you have a lot of home-based workers which receive advances from contractors. So the classic neo-bonded workforce you will find is likely to be here. While instead, if you look for what's happening in the south, this is much more likely to, forced labor is much more likely to manifest itself somewhere here in dormitories where women are actually promised lump sums of money at the end of a five-year period. In the particular scheme we're talking about here is the Sumangali scheme, which is actually deployed both in cotton as well as in parts of garments. So there have been like reports both in Tirupur as well as in Bangalore. So if you just look at forced labor, these are the type of paths you see across the sweatshop regime, but of course you can actually also talk about unfreedom in different ways. For instance, you can look at patterns of dispossession, or to what extent these workers actually only rely on garment work, or instead they're still connected to the land. Here again you have a different understanding of unfree and free workers, and you will have here a huge link still with the land. Our last survey shows that over 40% of people still own land back home, so in a sense they combine garment work with other types of activities during the lean season, while here instead you will have free workers that tend to have less land, at least in Bangalore and Chennai. And what we found really interestingly is that it's important for us to define the way in which we consider the freedom and freedom divide, because is there can be clear trade-offs, and they can change completely policy priorities. So for instance, during my fieldwork in UP, I started concerned with the male workers who were receiving baki, and therefore they were clearly neo-bonded workers, before realizing that these workers have much higher wages than the women that were not tied at all. So in this sense they were the freest of workers, but simply because patriarchy already tied them quite fine to the walls of the household, so the contractor didn't need to lock them into the labor relations via credit markets. So in a sense, for us to identify who are the poorest worker for policy priorities, this debate on freedom is really a crucial one. And both the liberal as well as the Marxist takes on freedom and bondage look quite limiting if you look at the multiple realities of the sweatshop regime. The third composing element of the sweatshop as a regime is that it's working as a joint enterprise. There is a huge tendency to actually trying to isolate the culprit when it comes to narrating the history of the sweatshop. And this is true in India as anywhere else. So for instance, even Indian trade unions tend to have a sort of narrative that places a lot of emphasis on buyers. So the global buyers are considered the only responsible for the poor working conditions of the workers themselves. But if you look at the way in which the sweatshop works and the way in which processes of surplus extraction takes place, it's clear that this is a joint action by multiple lords, and all of them have a very specific role to play in the creation and reproduction of the sweatshop. Well, instead, it seems to me they're like shifting fashions on who we consider responsible. And then, of course, this is very much linked to different policies, international, national, or otherwise, they're pushed during a particular phase of the development of the garment industry. Particularly, there is a sort of there are two opposing views that seem to emerge. One that considers surplus extraction as a vertical endeavor, so we identify the buyers as the bad person because he imposes a certain type of price onto the other. And instead, there are like more classic accounts that only consider the exploiter that has manufacturing capacity, which is another big mistake. Because this is a highly mercantile industry where production and circulation are really nicely combined, and they both serve the purpose of creating the platform for surplus extraction. So on the one hand, you cannot let someone that has no manufacturing capacity work scot-free because not involved in the actual extraction of surplus itself, as well as you cannot just identify the culprit by looking at manufacturing capacity or like direct links with the workforce. So there are like a number of actors that are involved: buyers, exporters, retailers, producers, labor contractors, and all they have a role to play in setting the sweatshop together. Now, the first thing that we need to do in order to counter these narratives they recall a little bit the radical theories of the 70s. They represent, developing regions as these undifferentiated lands that are therefore global capital to be exploited. Who is a global agent, particularly in today's economy? So that sometimes I feel that when you read on global sectors, we suffer from analytical orientalism. So we tend to use categories to crystallize categories such as global, national, regional, local, giving them meanings that, as a matter of fact, they do not necessarily have once we explore the type of processes in question. So, for instance, how would you define the global buyer in this industry? Someone Indian, not necessarily a global buyer. Well, the picture that I've downloaded there from El Mundo from 2010 is a picture of Pablo Isla, who is the CEO of the giant Zara. They're shaking hands with Noel Tata, who's the CEO of Trent, which is the retail branch of the Tata Group. And of course, they're very happy because they just signed the biggest tie-up in the history of retail in India. Of course, exploiting the liberalization of retail. And 49% of this massive tie-up is owned by the Tatas, and 51% by Zara. So in a sense, they also wear a similar tie, actually. So you cannot really see a big difference between these two actors. This is capital. This capital is capital is capital. The fact that one is India-based and the other one is Western-based is like it's irrelevant. The sweatshop is not imposed by global capital onto the local, but is imposed by capital onto labor. And there's a very cosmopolitan elite of businessmen that have dominated garment and textile, not just in contemporary times, but in a very long time. And tie-ups are just one form in which these agreements they cut across the world in terms of capital work. We talk about mergers, actual purchasing of shares. I'll break it to you, your Fab India t-shirt is likely to be owned 8% by the Louis Vuitton group, unless they even bought more in recent years. These were like 2010, it's a 2010 purchase. And also we have the rise of brands in India itself. So in a sense, this is the contemporary scenario, and also if you look at historically what was the reality of the Indian Ocean trade is also very similar. Because if you look at the work of historian like Tirthankar Roy, for instance, they stress very much how the history of Indian Ocean trade was hardly a history whereby the West dominated trade on Indian merchants, but there was a highly cosmopolitan class of merchants that dominated. And if you can actually also read the fantastic novels by Amitav Ghosh to have a sense of this. So circulation, it's a crucial aspect of this, because a lot of these mega players that I'm talking about, both Western and Indian, might own some manufacturing capacity, but primarily also dominate also via circulation. They dominate via their retail arm, their ability to be monopolist in actually placing orders. And as a matter of fact, both, as I mentioned at the beginning, both Indian as well as international buyers have a similar take on how you exploit this massive richness of the Indian garment mall. Now, circulation is as relevant at the top of the sweatshop regime as well as it is at the bottom of the sweatshop regime, because of course, when we think about the sweatshop, and you know, we read it on newspapers, or you open like the Hindu and you see the last story of a sweatshop scandal in Delhi, you also generally seen as portraits of not just workers in factories, but a huge number of workers in home-based settings. Of course, those workers are managed not directly by exporters, but they're managed by a particularly interesting class of actors who are also very much part of the sweatshop regime, who are labor contractors. And for labor contractors, circulation becomes crucial. Again, it's a fundamental part in which it's a fundamental aspect on how they create platforms for surplus extraction. Now, crucially, I would say that the case of the bottom of the sweatshop regime highlights how we need to take circulation seriously. Because while these are generally represented as mere intermediaries, these are actually petty capitalists, because they invest in what, according to their point of view, is the labor process at their enterprise, which is owning labor networks, and they do so via advances. Now, advances are generally represented in the Indian literature in the role of bonding labor, and of course there's a fantastic work on that by by Jan Breman, by people like Isabelle Guérin, David Pichery, Barbara herself, and I think there is a fundamental role for them to play vis-à-vis new bondage. However, they also a form of productive investment. So, in a sense, they use the advance in order to make sure that the direct producers can survive, and then you can extract a surplus. So, production and circulation relevant across both the upper echelon and the lower echelon of the sweatshop regime. The final constitutive element of the sweatshop as a regime, it's the sign it has on the body. And again, while the literature tend to stress a lot the impact that massive industrial disasters have, Rana Plaza, the Tazrin disaster in 2013 before the Dhaka one, 2 years later, Delhi one hit the leather factories. While we always only remember about the danger of the sweatshop during these moments of disaster, however, there is a low intensity epidemic, which is the reality of the sweatshop workers all across. During our last survey, we collected information for workers themselves, and what we could see is that there are aspects place workers on the same level, i.e. there are some health depleting effects which are common to all workers, like back pain, the development of bad allergies, etc. But then the sweatshop is also a regime whereby you have different ill effects on the basis of where you're located. So for instance, in larger factories, we found waves of fainting in line with the findings of other research teams, for instance, in Cambodia, that pushed the author, the journalist Julia Wallace, to write a great piece on the New York Times a few years back that was called Workers of the World Faint, because every day there was a systematic way in which these workers would have dropped like fly on the shop floor. So this is a problem linked to targets in large factories, while instead in small workshops there is a loss of eyesight. Now, this is due to many different reasons, but most of all to the lack of internalization of costs of social reproduction by employers, meaning that not only you don't have health provisions there for sweatshop workers, both in large factories as well as in small factories, but also you have that there is a general tendency towards assuming that workers have to continue absorbing these shocks, either going back home on a yearly basis, so continuing engaging in circular migration, or generally speaking, exiting the sweatshop very early. So, for instance, something which is very little talked about when it comes to representation of industries like garment and textile, particularly in the industrial development literature, is the fact that workers exit this type of jobs by the time they're 30, 35. And this is true for the Indian case, it's true for the Cambodian case, it's true for the Chinese case, and it's something which is never accounted for. So a lot is written about labor circulation. So if workers are migrant, not migrant, where do they go back to on a yearly basis? However, more should be written about the fact that there is a life cycle-based process of circulation which ends at 35. And Matthew asked me some of the things I'd like to do after. And indeed, one is engaging with issues of post-work. And I just ran a small pilot in Bangalore a year back, and I'm in the process of analyzing the life histories that I got from workers that actually do not work in the industry anymore. The idea is like to ask what do they do and which type of health effect actually they keep with them after they exit the sweatshop. So to conclude, given that Matthew showed me my 5 minutes post at least 3 minutes ago, so two general implications, quickly, and then on specifically on India. Well, the story of the sweatshop, I think, challenges very much the classic story of industrial transition, which is mainstream in many economics accounts. They see the sweatshop as a temporary evil on a pathway towards a sort of modern greater good. Well, actually, the sweatshop is temporary only in the lives of the workers that are part of it, simply because they will be exhausted by the time they're 35 and they'll be checked out. And don't get me wrong, many workers are retrenched as a matter of fact, but many others actually do choose not to engage in this work any longer because it's so taxing. What is quite interesting in our last survey is that one of the classic sub stories of this representation of industrial development is benign, that is the fact that size matter is not something that we found in the Indian context, and we can discuss why in the Q&A. So we found that large factories and small workshops actually pay extraordinarily similar take-home wages. What differs is in social contributions, but because you have such high level of circulation, then the social contribution, which are not portable according to Indian social policy, get wasted. Where do they end up? It's like the million dollar question. Actually, the Modi government promised to do something about portability ages ago. We're still waiting. The second debate is on modern slavery, and I would say that, as we've seen, there are many forms of unfreedom that actually cross the sweatshop regime, and not just the worst forms of abuse that the literature tend to focus on, and we need to actually broaden the debate on working conditions far beyond the issues of forced or trafficked labor, because otherwise the type of policy measures, both international and national, that we come up with can only engage with very minimum expectations. So if we accept that it's just fair enough just to keep workers alive, it's a very minimal threshold that we set indeed. On India, I would say both issues on stagism and on modern slavery are quite relevant. On the one hand, I would say that we are living in an era where stagism is definitely fetishized. The Modi government has actually proposed a labor law agenda, which is definitely pro-capital, and in that stagism is quite intrinsic. Particularly, labor intensity is proposed as the first sort of push moment. Then, of course, in his very colorful language, he just talks about releasing resources for the soldiers of development, that should be the entrepreneurs. But generally speaking, what is interesting about the Modi era is how the textile and garment sector have been used as a sort of basket case for all sorts of trials. Because what is taking place at the moment, which is this attempt at simplifying laws, 44 laws, into four main agendas, is something that has started in a way in the textile and garment sector over a year ago. So we had, for instance, an amendment to the Contract Labour Act, so that you can have an increased number of contract workers in the sector already for a while. We had, of course, that the industry had could benefit from the changes in child labor policy that also the government has been pushing for, and also the change in the apprenticeship forms. These changes have already taken place in many places in the garment industry, as they're being discussed at the moment for larger sectors of the economy. But also this is possible, I would like to say, not just because of this government, but because there has been, I would say, a sort of fascination with stagism also by previous governments, and this emphasis on the specter of jobless growth, I would say, has led even trade unions, I would say, to actually overlook issues of working conditions in certain sectors. So it's a very long time that in India the debate focuses on jobless growth and very little on growthless jobs. In terms of modern slavery, of course, the issue is different than the general Western literature, which is anyway very policy driven. India has a very long history in terms of studying bondage, neo-bondage. So of course the level of sophistication is higher, but I would say that instead in the Indian context there has been a dominance of classic Marxist studies on these particular issues, and there's been a lot of emphasis on male circulation, produced great work. It's a work that I learned a lot from, but if you look at the realities on the ground, they clearly show that at the moment the reality exceeds the definition that we have been working with so far, and particularly there is a need to gender and to gender the experiences of unfreedom, because you can see that bringing gender and caste into the picture, we have a far more complex reality indeed. I'll stop here. Thank you.